content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service. And for the next hour, I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated July 4/July 11, 2022. As usual, the outer border is in red with a smaller marginal white inner border in white. Time, in its usual large block capital lettering, is in white superimposed over gray, so it's like a screen print of grayish white or very light gray. And it is on top of a wave. This is a black and white and grays photograph. It's called the Ocean's Issue, Water's Untapped Power. This is like a surfing wave, according to what I've seen on movies and TV. It looks black, but again, this is a black and white photo with ripples in it, large, crunchy-looking ripples. And then it swoops over into an inverted U-shape and looks like frosting, like very frilly nylon tulle frosting in white, foamy, edgy. And then that fades into a gray background with some white clouds within that background. The first article, then, is Behind the Cover, Earth and Water, by D.W. Pine. And it says above, the setup for photographing the sculpture Plastic Waves, cover photo, sculpture by Hugh Kretschmer. So we were not looking at a giant wave off the coast of California or Hawaii, but this is a sculpture, and it looks like it's being displayed and photographed in the middle of kind of an arid desert landscape. There are plants growing, so maybe it's along a seaside. I can't identify them. They look oaty to me, but they do not look like Nebraska oatfield oats. So this sculpture that looks like this big, humongous, powerful wave is maybe 3 feet tall by 2.5 or 3 feet across. It is placed upon a platform of maybe plywood. It's hard to tell from this photo and the details. And it has all kinds of little frames and stanchions holding it in place. So the sculpture itself may be flexible. There's no description for that. But surrounding it on three sides are what appear to be some high-tech cameras to photograph the wave, the sculpture Plastic Waves. Time has covered the planet and the dramatic damage done to it by human beings for more than a half century. With the rise of modern environmentalism came a double-width fold-out on water use in 1965, and 2 years later a cover photo of polluted air over L.A. Our most famous such cover literally covered the planet. The conceptual artist Christo wrapped a 16-inch globe in polyethylene and rope and drove more than 350 miles up and down New York State's Long Island in search of the perfect combination of light, air, and sea to create the image Time used to announce that 1988 would not have a Person of the Year, but rather a Planet of the Year. I had the opportunity to meet with Christo in his New York City studio 3 years ago, along with Time editor-in-chief Felsenthal and executive editor Goldberger, that is Ben Goldberger, sitting with him in a large spare room adorned with diagrams showing his decades in the making plan to wrap the Arc de Triomphe in Paris, I was struck by the boldness of Christo's creativity and vision. He was thoughtful and confident, approaching creative challenges with a why not. He died less than a year later, before the new collaborations we discussed could become reality, and months before his team completed his dream of wrapping the arch in recyclable polypropylene fabric. There is no cover subject more important than climate change, and no single solution will cure the planet. Likewise, when approaching the visuals for a climate cover story, as Time's creative director, I believe it is important to present a variety of approaches, from large-scale sculptures to dramatic installations. For the April 26, 2021 cover, Malaysian artist Red Hong Yi spent 2 weeks creating an image that was part sculpture, part performance art. She constructed a 7.5-by-10-foot world map out of 50,000 green-tipped matchsticks and set the work on fire. No part of the globe escaped. And in 2019, Japanese sand sculptor Toshihiko Hosaka and his seven-person team created a 98-by-65-foot Time cover on the playground site of the former Ioka Junior High School in Ioka, Asahi, which closed after the East Japan earthquake in 2011. Their process involved raking sand for 8 hours a day for 7 days, followed by 2 days of fine adjustments. The piece was then photographed by drone. This week, we return to the ocean with a special package of stories examining the peril facing our seas, which also hold the potential to make a difference in the fight against a warming atmosphere. Our cover features another sculpture that reimagines the combination of light, air, and sea. California photographer Hugh Kretschmer spent 4 weeks constructing a 5-foot-wide wave sculpture made of recycled plastic garbage bags. I share a special kinship with the ocean. It is one of a handful of places I go to regroup, reset, refresh, and replenish, says Kretschmer, who drew inspiration from Robert Longo's charcoal drawing from his Epic Wave series. Blue is also the color of creativity, and many ideas of mine are born while walking the shores. He built plastic waves using pillow batting, aluminum screening, spackle, and garbage bags, which were laminated and heated onto the surface. The last and most time-consuming step was adding the waves foam and spray using translucent garbage bags in varied thicknesses. The oceans are so vital to our ecosystem that we must take notice and protect them, adds Kretschmer. Unfortunately, it seems that what's out of sight is out of mind. It is below the surface that the real tragedies are happening. Here's a small inset photo in this article written by D.W. Pine from left to right. All men, all casually dressed, but maybe a little more dressy the older they get. Felsenthal, Goldberger, Christo, and Pine in the artist's studio. Goldberger being the youngest and Christo the oldest. For the record, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 items here. 100 million estimated number of Americans with medical debt, including 41% of adults, according to an NPR and Kaiser Health News investigation released June 16. Elon's behavior in the public sphere is a frequent source of distraction and embarrassment for us, SpaceX employee said in a June 16 open letter to company executives about CEO Elon Musk. Do you know how it feels to have the President of the United States target you? Said Ruby Freeman, a 2020 Georgia election worker who was falsely accused of manipulating the vote count, in testimony aired June 21 before the January 6 committee. As a fat black woman in America, I've had many hurtful words used against me, so I understand the power words can have. By Lizzo Singer, in a June 13 Instagram post saying she was releasing an updated version of her song Girls after the lyrics sparked criticism from the disabled community. He was blue from all the beating. He could not even sit, says Ziba, the sister of a Muslim man who was beaten by Indian police in a viral video. Speaking to the BBC for a June 18 story, the officer's actions were praised by an official from the country's ruling party. 10%, the portion of weapons requested from the West that Ukraine has actually received, according to a June 14 statement from the country's Deputy Defense Minister, Hanna Malyar. Again, that's 10%. The dress was in the same condition it started in, said Amanda Joyner, VP at Ripley Entertainment, responding June 16 to claims Kim Kardashian returned Marilyn Monroe's Happy Birthday, Mr. President dress damaged after wearing it to the 2022 Met Gala. 69 cents, the price per gallon of gas, June 9, at a California station, a manager who said he meant to sell it at $6.99 and made an honest mistake, was fired. From NewsTicker, three short items here. Swimming group bans trans athletes. The International Swimming Federation announced it has effectively barred transgender people from competing in women's races. The new gender inclusion policy allows only people who transition before age 12 to compete in women's events. The rule went into effect June 20 with the support of 72% of national federations. Taxes can go to religious schools. Court. The Supreme Court ruled June 21 that Maine could not prevent parents from using tax-funded tuition assistance to send their children to private religious schools. The 6-3 ruling in Carson v. Macon is a win for school choice advocates who've pushed to use tax dollars to send children to schools outside the public system. Forest Service apologizes for NM wildfire. The U.S. Forest Service chief apologized June 21 for accidentally sparking the largest wildfire in New Mexico history. Embers left over from a controlled burn started the fire in April, which has destroyed hundreds of homes and is still burning. Good question. What does the bear market mean for investors and the U.S. economy? By Nick Popley. If you invested pandemic-era gains in the stock market or have a 401k, get ready for an anxiety-inducing ride. For the first time in nearly 2 years, the stock market crossed into bear market territory in June. Concerns about inflation have sent the S&P 500 spiraling down more than 20% from its record high in early January. Experts predict stocks will continue to tumble after the Federal Reserve raised interest rates by 0.75%, the biggest jump since 1994, in a continued effort to fight inflation. Wall Street uses the term bear market to describe a sustained period when the equity markets are down at least 20% from their recent peaks. Passing the 20% threshold typically indicates widespread pessimism about the health of the U.S. economy and negative investor sentiment. Such steep downturns are relatively rare, occurring only 14 times since World War II. In these bear markets, it took an average of 19 months for stock prices to stop falling, according to analysis by LPL Financial, an investment advisor. But the last bear market carried on for only 33 days, from mid-February to late March 2020, at the start of the COVID-19 pandemic. In order for a bear market to end in relatively quick fashion, as it did in 2020, it usually takes some sort of catalyst to get investors excited about stocks again, says Emily Bowersock Hill, chief executive of Bowersock Capital Partners, a financial management firm. During the last bear market, investors had the cryptocurrency craze, meme stocks, new technology companies, and stimulus checks to rally around. This time it is less clear what the silver lining will be. We're either going to need to see some surprisingly good earnings, which I think is quite unlikely, or would need some kind of improvement in the conflict between Russia and Ukraine, which I would consider equally unlikely, Hill says. The downturn could have some investors looking to pull their money from the market to avoid further losses, but that might be the wrong strategy. Bear markets have historically been an opportune time for investors to accumulate wealth over the long term as stock prices are lower. You could sell now and probably save yourself some short-term pain, says Victoria Green, chief investment officer at G Squared Private Wealth, an investment advisor, but you risk missing out when the market turns around and you are buying back at a higher price. Wildlife. Natural law. New York State's highest court tackled a philosophical question when it ruled June 14 that Happy the elephant is not legally considered a person and thus not detained against her will at the Bronx Zoo, as an advocacy group argued. Here, other rulings on the nature of animals by Julia Zorthian. Bees are fish. A court in California ruled May 31 that through a wording loophole, bumblebees can qualify as fish and therefore receive protection from the state's Endangered Species Act. No monkey copyrights. And here is a photo of a, what appears to be, smiling primate, complete with beautiful big amber eyes and kind of a little crew cut. And it has a dark charcoal gray complexion on its face and its fur, and it's being photographed against a lush green verdant background. Anyway, no monkey copyrights. In 2016, a federal judge ruled that since he was not human, Naruto the macaque could not own the copyright for a selfie he snapped using a photographer's camera. Well, that must be the selfie that I'm looking at, because the guy is smiling. And finally, the private lives of dogs. A New Jersey court decided in 2021 that while towns must share data about residents who own dogs, details about the dogs, such as name and breed, must be kept confidential. Under the heading Education, billions spent on hardening may not make schools safer. This is by Katie Riley. Beside pencil sharpeners and calendars and classrooms throughout Minnesota's Lakeville area schools, there are now big blue boxes with a red button and the word police, and police is in capital letters. The button sends a text message to emergency dispatchers, alerts the rest of the school to potential danger, and activates 1,200 pounds of magnetic force to keep the door shut. It is one of the measures that Michael Bauman has implemented to harden the schools in his district and protect against active shooters since he became superintendent in 2017. He hired 4 more counselors to improve mental health services, established a team to monitor potential threats of violence, and spent $14.4 million installing the emergency alert system and building ballistic panels into walls that are designed to stop bullets, all aimed at helping students and teachers survive an active shooter. Everybody goes to bed and thinks, that'll never happen in my school district. Well, I can tell you, as a superintendent, that is the nightmare, says Bauman, who previously served in the Army deploying to Iraq and Afghanistan. I felt like it was my obligation to do what I could. Fear of shootings has turned school security into a booming industry. The market for school security equipment and services reached $2.7 billion in 2017, according to a report by the research firm Omdia. That was before the 2018 shooting at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, further increased the focus on security measures at schools. The school shooting in Uvalde, Texas, May 24, has reignited the discussion about whether safety measures at schools can deter or stop mass shootings. And many Republicans, after indicating they're not willing to support gun safety legislation, have argued instead that heightened physical security measures are necessary to prevent future attacks. But experts say it is not clear such measures actually make schools safer. Research shows the number of deadly shootings at schools has increased since 2012, during a period in which protective measures also expanded. There also is not clear evidence that school resource officers, SROs, improve safety. SROs were on the scene in Uvalde and in Parkland before the gunmen entered the schools, but failed to stop those shootings. When we add metal detectors, surveillance cameras, increased police presence, active shooter drills, and we turn schools into this mix of fortresses and prison, it can have some negative impacts, says Brian Warnick, an education professor at Ohio State University who has studied school discipline. Although many school districts invest in security in the hopes of preventing shootings or minimizing casualties, some worry that hardening schools ultimately makes educators responsible for solving the gun violence epidemic. We ask schools to turn themselves upside down with trainings and new procedures, Warnick says. It's a larger societal problem of easy access to firearms, of lack of access to mental health care. Milestones. Moving on. The boys of BTS, the global phenoms, shift their focus. Here's a photo of 7 members of BTS who are starting a new chapter, their label says. They all look like teenagers, and maybe they are in this photo. Really dressed classy, suits, and some have white shirts and ties, and some have open-collared shirts, and some have red vests under spiffy-looking gray tunic coats, and they're wearing plaid shirts, and they've got blonde hair, and they've got brown hair, and red hair, and black hair, and they're smiling, some of them, and some of them are looking glum, and they're all wearing black shoes and either gray or black socks. Raisa Bruner writes, seated at a feast in the style of Leonardo da Vinci's The Last Supper, the 7 members of BTS celebrated their 9th anniversary as a band. The visual reference was apt. During a video of the mid-June dinner, the biggest musical act in the world dropped an industry-shaking bomb. They were starting a fresh chapter and prioritizing their solo careers. We have to accept that we've changed, rapper and group leader RM said. The problem with K-pop and the whole idol system is they don't give you time to mature. Suga made clear the group is not disbanding, and Jungkook clarified in another video that this is not a hiatus. Still, the news took on a life of its own. Over almost a decade together, the band has broken nearly every charting and YouTube record, been the foundational act of parent company HYBE and propelled K-pop into global consciousness. Recently, BTS picked up 6 Billboard number one hits in just over a year. June 10, members released an anthology album, Proof, that ties a bow on their works so far. HYBE, H-Y-B-E, shared in an official statement that this new chapter would encompass solo projects as well as group projects, allowing personal growth. Still, their future musical output as a group is uncertain. Korea's required military service means that at least one member will be unavailable for the next 3 years, and hiatus or no, the change has a bottom-line impact for HYBE, or HYBE. Share prices fell nearly 30% the day the news broke, with the company losing about $1.7 billion in market value, according to Bloomberg. The members of BTS have always pursued side work, from mixtapes to collaborations. First out of the gate in this new era will be J-Hope, who has a solo album in the works and is set to perform at Chicago's Lollapalooza in July. In the meantime, non-musical projects like a web series and a mobile game show the group will continue to plan and release new content to fans. The new chapter may be bittersweet, but it's also an opportunity to get to know the artists as individuals. BTS has long been dedicated to serving its global fan base. Next up, putting themselves first. And more short items from the Milestones page. Retired Microsoft's Internet Explorer June 15 after nearly 27 years when the company stopped supporting the browser. Sank Hong Kong tourist attraction Jumbo Kingdom, a 3-story floating restaurant, into the South China Sea June 19 while it was being towed. Auctioned Russian journalist Dmitry Muratov's Nobel Peace Prize medal for $103.5 million, June 20, with proceeds going to Ukrainian child refugees. Won, that's W-O-N, the NBA championship by the Golden State Warriors for the 4th time in 8 years, June 16, over the Boston Celtics in 6 games. Sentenced. 3 former fraternity brothers at Bowling Green State University to up to 28 days in jail, June 16, for the hazing death of a fellow student last year, announced the appointment of Marilyn Lynn Malerba, the first Native American, to serve as U.S. Treasurer, June 21, by the White House. Here's more brief news. First of all, a photograph. It looks dismal. A gray blue sky with gray hills in the background, in the middle ground towards the front, just a demolished, wrecked gray building that may have been stucco, may have been stone, may have been cement. It's gray and it has no roof. It still has a pair of wooden doors. And then in the foreground, very sad and dismal-looking people huddled around the entrance to that dismal wreck of a building. Maybe there are some women there. I see some shawls and head coverings. I see kind of pillbox-looking head coverings on what may be men carrying very large gun-like weapons. It's called Country in Crisis. Afghans survey the destruction caused by a powerful earthquake that struck the eastern province of Paktika June 22, leaving at least 1,000 people dead and many more injured. The 5.9 magnitude quake, the country's deadliest since 2002, is the latest humanitarian crisis to hit Afghanistan since the Taliban took power last August. From the bulletin, what its first leftist leader might mean for Colombia, by Eloise Berry. Former guerrilla rebel Gustavo Petro made history June 19 when he was elected Colombia's first ever leftist president. Achieving a narrow victory over populist outsider Rodolfo Hernandez with 50.4% of the vote. Petro, P-E-T-R-O, is viewed as a radical figure in a famously conservative country, seeking to reshape relations with the U.S. and willing to cooperate with Nicolas Maduro's regime in Venezuela. The president-elect's platform includes an end to oil exploration, tax hikes on the richest 4,000 Colombians, and nationalizing pension plans. It struck a chord with voters frustrated by deep-set inequality in the country. But Petro faces many hurdles. His coalition remains a minority in a Congress still dominated by conservative lawmakers. Nonetheless, violent police crackdowns on the 2021 protests against proposed tax hikes exacerbated distrust in the political establishment and signaled that voters were ready for change. In a country still reeling from the decades-long conflict between the government, far-right paramilitary groups, and leftist guerrilla movements, Petro is polarizing. Still, many voters appeared uncomfortable with Hernandez, a Trump-esque TikTok sensation who beat out traditional conservative candidates May 29 to advance to the runoff election. Petro's election makes Colombia the latest country swept up in Latin America's new pink tide, which has seen former student organizer Gabriel Boric elected president of Chile and former president Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva atop opinion polls in Brazil. The wave could also upend Colombia's relationship with the U.S., whose influence in the region has been waning for some time. Petro has pledged to prosecute security forces accused of human rights violations, many of whom received training from the U.S. Army, restructure trade relations with the U.S., and abandon the ineffective war on drugs. Three more brief news tickers. Israel headed for yet another election. Israel is on track for its fifth election in 3 years after the coalition government headed by Prime Minister Naftali Bennett announced June 20 it would submit a bill to dissolve parliament. The coalition, made up of 8 parties brought together by opposition to former PM Benjamin Netanyahu, struggled to govern since it lost its majority in April. UK approves Julian Assange extradition. WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange can be extradited to the US to face charges under the Espionage Act, UK Home Secretary Preeti Patel said June 17. Assange has 14 days to appeal the decision. He's wanted for publishing leaked intelligence documents that revealed human rights abuses and civilian killings by the U.S. military in Iraq and Afghanistan. Asian allies to attend first NATO summit. Leaders of Japan and South Korea are attending their first NATO summit as observers starting June 28. It's a sign the two Asian nations near Russia's eastern border are moving closer to the Western alliance after the invasion of Ukraine. More from the brief news under the heading Nation. January 6 hearings could spur update of 19th century law by Eric Cortalesa. For 6 months, a bipartisan group in Congress has been quietly working to overhaul the Electoral Count Act, the 1887 law that Donald Trump and his allies tried to exploit January 6, 2021, to overturn the presidential election. Advocates are hopeful that momentum is now on their side after the House committee investigating the Capitol attack shone a spotlight on the little-known statute. During the committee's public hearings in June, witnesses from Trump's inner circle explained how lawyer John Eastman spurred him to take advantage of supposed ambiguities in the law. Eastman wanted Vice President Mike Pence, in his role presiding over the congressional certification of the Electoral College, to reject the results in some states, thereby blocking Joe Biden's victory. Most Trump administration officials recognized the reasoning behind Eastman's scheme as fallacious. They thought he was crazy, former White House aide Jason Miller told the committee. There was no basis in the Constitution or laws of the United States at all for the theory espoused by Mr. Eastman, testified J. Michael Luttig, a former federal judge and advisor to Pence. Eastman himself allegedly acknowledged the criminality of his proposal. Greg Jacob, a lawyer for Pence, said Eastman told Trump in a meeting 2 days before the Capitol riot that the plan was illegal. Even though most legal experts agree, Eastman's reading of the Electoral Count Act was an egregious distortion. The January 6 committee is still preparing to push for changing the statute to make it clearer, in hopes of preventing anything like the Capitol attack in the future. Sources familiar with the matter say the panel will announce recommendations after the hearings and include them in a report set to be published in the fall. Congress passed the Electoral Count Act after the contentious 1876 election, when Republican Rutherford B. Hayes defeated Democrat Samuel Tilden. Several states had submitted competing slates of electors, and Congress went weeks before resolving the conflict, partly because there were no rules for how to handle such a crisis. The Electoral Count Act provided those rules, but in language that is vague and archaic. Lawmakers who support updating the law believe it is one of the few measures that can make it through a hyperpartisan Congress. There is broad consensus, Tom Tillis, a Republican senator for North Carolina, tells Time. But if legislators intend to change the law before the next presidential election, the window may be closing fast. Waiting until after the hearings conclude would give lawmakers a few weeks at most before Congress begins its summer recess, and legislation rarely passes in the fall of an election year. It may become far more difficult to update the law if Republicans gain control of one or both chambers of Congress. Hill sources familiar with the process say concern is growing that legislators are way behind schedule if they hope to pass the law before the November elections. Still, the committee vows to press the issue forward. Representative Stephanie Murphy, a Florida Democrat and a member of the January 6 panel, argues that too much is at stake. We should want to make sure, she says, that no one has the ability to overthrow the will of the American people. From the brief health, vaccines. What to know about COVID-19 shots for the youngest kids, by Jamie Ducharme and Alice Park. Parents in the U.S. have waited many months to get their kids under age 5 vaccinated against COVID-19. The green light finally came June 17, when the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, FDA, authorized two vaccines, one made by Pfizer-BioNTech and the other by Moderna, for kids as young as 6 months. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, formally recommended the shots the next day. The agencies say vaccinating kids is a safe, important way to protect them from the most severe disease outcomes, including hospitalization and death. Although rates of serious COVID-19 in young kids are relatively low, hospitalizations are creeping up, possibly because of the dominance of the Omicron variant. According to the latest CDC data, more than 2.5 million cases of COVID-19 have occurred among children 4 years old and younger since the start of the pandemic, and more than 440 have died. The two shots for young kids have some key differences. Pfizer BioNTech's is 3 doses, whereas Moderna's is 2. In a Pfizer-BioNTech study involving more than 4,500 children, the shots were about 80% effective at protecting against symptomatic disease, while Omicron was spreading widely. Although that estimate was based on such a small number of confirmed cases, it is difficult to know how protective it is in real-world situations. In Moderna's trials of more than 6,300 children, the shots were about 37% effective at protecting against symptomatic disease from Omicron in 2 to 5 year olds and 50% in kids ages 6 months to 2 years. The dosages also differ between companies, but both give the youngest children lower doses than those adults and older kids receive. In order to balance the shot's protective benefits against the risks of side effects. These include fever and swelling at the injection site, along with rarer, more serious conditions like multi-system inflammatory syndrome in children, MISC, a condition that can cause inflammation in many parts of the body. Side effects reported among kids were similar to those reported among adults. Moderna's two-dose regimen could be more convenient and mean fewer office visits for the youngest children compared with Pfizer-BioNTech's three-dose schedule. It would also take much less time for kids to become fully vaccinated. On the other hand, Pfizer-BioNTech's three doses appear to provide higher levels of virus-fighting antibodies in studies, although the differing dosages and study designs cannot be directly compared. Ultimately, additional doses may be recommended for all children, given that the current vaccines were designed to target the original SARS-CoV-2 virus. Omicron, which is better able than past variants to evade vaccine-induced immunity, has since replaced it. By the fall, health officials may have enough data from newer Omicron-specific vaccines to decide whether everyone, including children, should receive at least one dose of updated vaccine to remain adequately protected during winter. For now, the arrival of two safe and effective vaccines for the youngest Americans is a real milestone, says Dr. Yvonne Maldonado, who chairs the Committee on Infectious Diseases for the American Academy of Pediatrics and is chief of infectious diseases in pediatrics at Stanford School of Medicine. Parents now have a choice, she says, which is helpful. Here's a photograph of a highway, a two-lane highway with double yellow lines down the road. It's being encroached upon by what looks like a nasty flood. It is not on the Outer Banks, by the way. It's in a mountainous region with scruffy vegetation on its rocky hillsides. And this, actually, part of this flood has encroached upon one section of the highway where it is totally crumbled, not just half of it or one lane, but it's all gone there for several feet. This is called the Lightbox page. Actually, it's a double page. Wonderland Washout. The photograph is by Jacob W. Frank of the National Park Service. After historic floods forced Yellowstone National Park to shut down temporarily and washed out this road in the park, seen June 18, thousands of visitors were forced to evacuate. The extreme weather, which experts warn will likely become more common because of climate change, cut off electricity in the area. Parts of the park reopened for a limited number of visitors June 22, but some attractions may be closed for months. The Park Service is allocating $50 million to address the damage. The View, Our Broken International System by Angelina Jolie. More than 2 children are killed every day on average in the conflict in Ukraine. 4 more are injured. After over 100 days of war, almost 2/3 of Ukrainian children have been displaced. Conflict exposes the vulnerability of children and greatly increases it. Beyond the physical harm, which is to say beyond the injuries that can be seen, there is the trauma. There's the effect of displacement, of nights spent listening to bombardment, of being separated from family, of seeing friends and relations killed. Trauma stops the dreaming, not just the kind replaced by nightmares, but the dreaming that pulls life forward, the thinking about what we might create, what we might improve, whom we might love. Trauma destroys what the child was born to be. We're more aware of the reality and impact of war than ever before, but for all our awareness, the risk to children is getting greater. There are now more conflicts raging than at any point since the Second World War. Worldwide, one in six children, 426 million, lives in a conflict zone. The conflict in Ukraine has taken the number of displaced people worldwide past 100 million, higher than ever before recorded. More than one in 100 people worldwide are displaced as a refugee, asylum seeker, or within their own country. Beyond the population of the UK or France or Germany, of these 100 million, perhaps 40 million are children forced from their homes and their communities. For them, the future looks bleak. We have to recognize that our systems for preventing conflict and mass human displacement and for defending human rights are not working. Three-quarters of refugees live in protracted situations where a return to their country of origin is impossible because the problems they fled persist. Aid relief is now stretched so thin that the UN's World Food Program has said that in Yemen, we have no choice but to take food from the hungry to feed the starving. And in a few weeks, we risk not even being able to feed the starving. In Afghanistan, NGOs fear hunger may kill more people than the past 20 years of war. The U.S. National Intelligence Council has warned refugee rights are among the norms at the highest risk of weakening globally in the next decade, meaning that unless we act, there will be even less agreement about how to protect refugees. We cannot wait for current crises to pass or for leadership to emerge at an international level before we ask what needs to change. Aid relief is supposed to be a temporary solution provided without discrimination. Refugees and displaced people are supposed to be able to return home safely after conflicts as a result of diplomacy and peace agreements. Human rights standards are supposed to be applied consistently. Instead, we see examples of refugees apparently being discriminated against on the basis of their skin color, religion, or country of origin. The world's poorest countries host millions of refugees for decades without an end in sight, while the richest devise ever more elaborate ways of closing their borders and offshoring asylum seekers. We need to acknowledge what it would take to bring down the number of refugees globally. We need to understand the deep level of human suffering of the people in these situations, and we need to recognize that we are still living in old ways with old behaviors. We've not adjusted our institutions to meet the new, still shaping world. Because of the way the UN was set up, it is tipped toward the interests and voices of powerful nations at the expense of those people suffering the most from conflict and persecution, whose rights and lives are not treated equally. For decades, its main focus has been the work of international organizations. There's not been enough listening to local groups and volunteers and strengthening their efforts. I do not pretend to have the answers, but I'm with all those who are searching for a new way. A lot of the strength I see at this time comes from the individual people in countries affected by conflict like Ukraine, and from local organizations, volunteers, and refugees themselves, who are not waiting to be helped, but are supporting each other. That is where I put my faith and hope. Until we have the courage to rebuild our international institutions and to live up to the promise of equal rights and protection for all. The author, Jolie, is a Time contributing editor, an Academy Award-winning actor, and humanitarian. Here is the seven questions page written by Alice Park. It's in the question and answer format. Dr. Ashish Jha, that's A-S-H-I-S-H, space, J-H-A, the U.S.'s new COVID-19 response coordinator, shares his mask policy and hints at what we can expect when it comes to boosters in the fall. You have gained quite a following on Twitter, but social media also spreads misinformation about COVID-19. How do you separate the reliable information from the about the pandemic from the noise? Answer, I think Twitter has been a net positive because it brings people together. The question is, how do you balance that against the incentives on Twitter, which are often to be more provocative and share stuff that has more shock value? For me, it's always been about not focusing on metrics like retweets or likes, but whether people I communicate with find the information I am sharing useful. When I read Twitter, I ask myself, how much expertise do these people really have? Having an MD or PhD is not enough. I look to people who did not start thinking about public health and infectious diseases for the first time in 2020, but rather who've been thinking about these issues for years. You are known for communicating well about complicated scientific topics. How do you accomplish that? Answer. I begin by thinking about my audience and remind myself my audience is people like my mother, who does not know anything about medicine or public health, but is smart and certainly does not want to be talked down to, not from her son, but not from anybody. Since you took on your new role in March, what has been the biggest challenge? Answer. The recognition that this pandemic is not over and that the virus continues to evolve in significant ways. It was very clear as I came in that we're winning the battle, but we need to keep fighting, trying to explain that the battle is not over and that we are winning because we're doing the right things, and that if we stop, it's going to be a huge problem, is a big challenge. Where has the U.S. response fallen short? Answer. In the first few months of the pandemic, back in 2020, I talked more about testing than everything else combined. I believed then and believe now that testing is a fundamental part of an effective pandemic response, and we have seen how much the initial response under the Trump administration bungled building up the testing infrastructure. Tests not only diagnose, they actually help slow down the spread of the virus. If you have easy access to tests, you can isolate if you're positive. This administration has leaned in pretty heavily on building the testing infrastructure and making sure tests are widely available. What is your mask policy? Answer. I wear a mask whenever I'm in an indoor space that's crowded and poorly ventilated, and I don't have a sense of people's vaccination status. And I do think about infection levels. A month ago, I was in Massachusetts where infection rates were high, so I wore a mask before walking into a grocery store. Will we have a new vaccine for boosting in the fall? Answer. That is an FDA decision. We have new data coming in on vaccines that have a little bit of Omicron and a little bit of the original virus. The FDA is going to look at that data and make a decision in the next couple of weeks before July. I think more probably we're going to have a new formulation of vaccine that should be more effective against Omicron and more effective at preventing infection, and hopefully provide more durable protection as well. But we will see. If you were seriously ill with COVID-19, in which country would you choose to be treated? Answer. The number one place I'd like to be is the U.S. When it comes to therapeutics, we're second to none in making sure if people are infected and at high risk of serious disease, they can get treatments. I'm not just trying to be rah-rah America, but I really do think that from a data point of view, it's clear we're getting more therapeutics out and doing a better job of preventing people from getting seriously ill than anyone else. The DC Brief by Philip Elliott, Washington correspondent. Nevada Republicans voted June 14 to nominate an election denialist as the state's top elections official, an outcome that would be worrisome even if it were an isolated incident. It is not. Jim Marchant beat out six other Republican candidates vying to be the party's nominee for Secretary of State. Marchant is hardly the first electoral fabulist, and almost certainly not the last. In the good old days, most voters could not describe the role, let alone name the person in it. The holder of the gig was an elevated technocrat who made sure businesses were registered, state archives were maintained, and notaries public were current. But after former President Donald Trump urged some election chiefs to set aside election results for political advantage, the public began to better understand the power they wield. So too did MAGA congregants who are now seeking offices to help Trump and his big lie in 2024. The result is a danger to the electoral system itself. The fever does not look to be breaking anytime soon, and nothing less than democracy is in play. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.